Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Renal Cell Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And I do also want to call out that the Kidney Cancer Association and Kidney Cancer Canada have also collaborated on this particular program in joining to spread the word about the program. And because of that collaboration and all of your interest in the topic today, we have over 464 participants on the call. And you come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So you really are from all over the world, and we're delighted you're with us today to learn about more about renal cell cancer. Today's program was supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this important program today, and actually for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this program possible. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I do want to actually say something to all of you before we start, is that we do have the first part of the program, we will have the speakers presenting. The second half hour, you do have a chance to ask questions and queue up and ask questions either on the phone or online. And I would suggest that you take notes if you want to ask a question during the Q&A so that you're all set to ask a question if you should think of one during the Q&A. So our first speaker is Dr. Matthew Campbell. And Dr. Campbell is Assistant Professor, Department of Genitourinary Medical Oncology, the University of Texas, and the Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Campbell is going to discuss an overview of renal cell cancer, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, targeted cancer therapies. It's really my pleasure to bring this program to Dr. Campbell and to introduce Dr. Campbell and to have him now present to you. Dr. Campbell?
Hi, everyone. It's my honor to join everyone today and calling from beautiful, sunny Houston, Texas. So kidney cancer is a cancer that is, I would say, in the top 10 of most common cancer. So it's not the most common cancer of all, which is lung cancer, but it's certainly not one of the least common. So in the United States each year, around 60,000 cases of kidney cancer is diagnosed each year. And so those kidney cancers that are diagnosed can't come from the meat of the kidney or kind of the funnel system. The majority are from the meat of the kidney, and so that would be over 90% of kidney cancers. The rest would be from the renal pelvis, and I will not focus on those today, which are treated more like a bladder cancer. So among kidney cancers, and when I refer to that again, that's the meat of the kidney, 75% of those are the most common type, which is clear cell kidney cancer, and the remaining 25% are made up of a hodgepodge of other cancers like papillary kidney cancer, which can be type 1 or type 2, chromophobe kidney cancer, and then a variety of other more rare subtypes. And the majority of my talk today will focus on the clear cell subtype, and if anyone has more specific questions in regards to the non-clear cell histologies, I'm happy to speak more about those. So when we think about kidney cancer, based on where the kidneys lie in the body, they lie behind where the intestines are. They lie in a space that's called the retroperitoneum. And because they lie in this space, kidney masses can grow quite large before they often cause symptoms. So it's very common for patients that have more advanced kidney cancer to have a mass that is anywhere from 10 to 20 centimeters in size, which is a very, very large mass. That's, if you're going to convert that to inches, between a 6 and 8-inch mass, that can be growing before it causes any problems. If kidney cancer has not spread outside of the kidney, the optimal treatment is surgery. And so we work very closely with our surgery colleagues, and our surgery colleagues help us in both patients that have cancer just within their kidney, as well as patients that have had cancer spread outside of their kidney. Kidney cancer is a very interesting cancer from the standpoint of, unlike lung cancer, breast cancer, and many other cancer types, even if the cancer has spread away from the kidney, there can still be a role of removal of the kidney and the cancer. We work with our surgeons closely in these cases, and we try to determine how well the patients are and if they seem like they are a good match to going to the operating room in those cases. So in the cases where the kidney cancer is confined to the kidney and the surgeon goes in and removes the kidney, there is no role at this time for any additional therapy after to try to prevent the cancer from coming back outside of consideration of a clinical trial. And so the remainder of my talk is really going to focus on metastatic kidney cancer or stage 4 kidney cancer. And these are kidney cancers that have spread outside of the kidney and have gone to other places in the body. So kidney cancer really knows no boundaries, and kidney cancer often will spread to the lung, will spread to lymph nodes in the chest or the abdomen. It can spread to the bone, can spread to liver, can spread to the brain, can spread to muscle. It can spread to lots of different locations. And so the most common places, again, lung and lymph node, but then other sites become less common, but we certainly see patients that have it spread to multiple different areas. Occasionally, though, we have it just spread to one or two sites. If the cancer has spread only to one site and it happens many years or even a year after the initial surgery, we will often talk to surgeons if it's possible to remove that area of new site. And so again, these are sometimes complicated cases, and I think seeing physicians that have a lot of experience in kidney cancer can be very beneficial. So moving on to more of the systemic therapy. And so when you look at the history of development of drugs for kidney cancer, it's quite a fascinating story. And so if you go back just over 10 years ago, the only treatment that had been FDA approved in the United States for the treatment of kidney cancer were medications that basically stimulated the immune system. And so those were cytokines like high-dose interleukin-2. This therapy was very toxic, but it carried a chance of cure in 5 to 7% of patients who received it. And the remainder of patients who received this toxic therapy didn't seem to tremendously benefit. And so it was a head scratcher. It's still a therapy that we sometimes consider in patients that are very fit and very young with kidney cancer, because it promises in patients that do have the complete response that is durable a potential for cure without additional therapy, and so it's something that we still consider. Additional therapies for kidney cancer that I'll go through were developed in the mid-2000s, and then one is more recent, which I'll get to toward the end. And so in the mid-2000s, after a long amount of research, it was understood that kidney cancer, the most common type again being clear cell, is driven by loss of a gene called VHL. What VHL does is it helps break down a protein in these kidney cancer cells that when it's on basically acts like the cells do not have enough oxygen. And when the cells do not have enough oxygen, what happens is they secrete these signals into their environment to have the blood vessels start to grow and start to feed these tumors. And so these drugs, which we call targeted therapy, they're called VEGF inhibiting drugs. These are drugs like Nexavar, which is sorafenib, or sunitinib, which is Sutent, pazopanib, which is known as Votrient, Inlyta, which is axitinib, and now likely cabozantinib, which is Cometriq, will hopefully be on the market in the near time if the FDA approves it. And so these drugs, again, block more so in the blood vessels than the kidney cancer themselves. And Dr. Joseph, in his next part of the talk, is going to talk about the potential side effects and how to manage these drugs. But what we can say is that these drugs in about a third of patients will cause the shrinkage of the tumors, and about another 50% or so will have a stable cancer, and then sometimes the cancers will continue to grow and they'll be more resistant to this type of therapy. At this time, the standard therapeutic approach is that in patients that have metastatic disease for kidney cancer, we often will start a drug like Sutent or Votrient as the initial therapy if we're using standard of care. When we think about patients that have metastatic disease in clinic, we think about we start to lump them into different groups based upon the number of symptoms they're having and what their laboratory work looks like, and that helps guide us into different risk groups of how aggressive their cancer is behaving. And that does have some influence in the type of therapies that we choose. But even patients that have very aggressive cancers, we normally will try to start Sutent or Votrient first. An agent that proved to be very beneficial in patients, which was approved at the end of 2015, is a drug called Opdivo or Nivolumab. And this is a very exciting new drug in the treatment of metastatic kidney cancer, and it's also been approved in the treatment of metastatic melanoma and in the treatment of non-small cell lung cancers. And so this drug basically works by influencing how the immune system sees cancer cells. So I like to think of these drugs as basically these tumors try to hide in the camouflage, which is this PDL ligand that sticks up from its surface trying to hide from the immune system. When the immune system cells are very tired, they also put this flag up that doesn't allow them to see the cancer cells. When this flag or this camouflage is removed, the immune system can then see the cancer cell as being a bad foreign cell and then cause it to be attacked. So these therapies have very different side effects than the standard kidney cancer side effects, and Dr. Joseph will maybe mention these during this portion of the talk. But this right now is one of the first drugs that has been used after the cancer grows following the first treatment that has shown an improvement in how long patients live. And so this is a drug that we're very, very excited about, and this is a drug that has now been approved and is often now given second in the line of treatments. So to date, there have been a total of 8 cancer therapies that have been approved. I've already discussed the 4 VEGF agents. An additional agent is called Avastin, and it works a little bit differently than the medications I talked about before, which are all oral pills. Avastin is an intravenous injection that's given typically every 2 weeks, and when it's given every 2 weeks, it basically works by binding this blood vessel stimulating factor that's circulating in the bloodstream, and again helps to prevent these growth of blood vessels. And so the last class of drugs in this disease are what's called the mTOR inhibitors. The mTOR inhibitors affect the cancer cells' energy sensing, their nutrition, their survival. And these are medications that have been shown to be active in kidney cancer and appear to be the most active in the most aggressive forms of kidney cancer. And these are ones that we tend to use later in the treatment lines. And so kidney cancer is it's a very interesting cancer to treat on a lot of levels because every patient tends to respond differently to these medications. We certainly see reoccurring side effects. But patients that often do have side effects seem to be patients that benefit from these treatments. And when we're really thinking about helping patients with metastatic kidney cancer, certainly balancing quality of life when using these medications is very important. So I think having a very good relationship with your oncologist and having a close connection in terms of what side effects you're experiencing really help keep patients on therapy longer, and we know that patients that are compliant and take their medications and have medications adjusted when there are side effects tend to do much better than when medications are stopped prematurely and no further adjustments are made. So I think certainly working with people that have a lot of experience in kidney cancer can be very beneficial. The new treatment approaches that we're really looking for right now are looking at how we can make immunotherapy more active in patients. And so this drug that I spoke about, Opdivo, or I've looked at it with different combinations, whether it's with another immune drug or if it's with a targeted therapy. And there have been some early exciting leads in these directions. And so we are right now emerging into an era of time for the treatment of kidney cancer that is very fast moving, very exciting. And it's a time where I think tremendous progress is being made across a lot of different fronts. And with that, I'm going to turn it over back to Carolyn to introduce Dr. Joseph. So I thank everyone for their attention today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Campbell. That was really outstanding, a wonderful really overview and just presentation of the treatments for renal cell cancer, for kidney cancer, really very helpful to everybody. And our next speaker, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Richard Joseph, and Dr. Joseph is medical oncologist, Mayo Clinic, Florida, assistant professor of medicine, division of hematology and oncology, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Joseph is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, managing side effects and pain, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Joseph.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you for having me here. It's a real pleasure to reach out to patients and providers and whoever's on the call and talk about kidney cancer, a cancer that I think is kind of sometimes overlooked. So the first topic of discussion today is the role of clinical trials and how research contributes to your treatment options. And this is a discussion that I think when I bring up with patients for the first time is met with a lot of skepticism at first. I think most patients, majority of my patients, tend to think of clinical trials as placing patients as a guinea pig, as someone who is not going to receive any active therapy. They don't want to have a placebo, and kind of think of them as this is not going to really benefit me, but maybe it might benefit the future, but not necessarily me. And I kind of want to at least review that concept and probably dispel the myths of that concept. So clinical trials are obviously extremely important for us to gather information in a prospective fashion so that we can decide what are truly, in fact, the best treatment for patients. All clinical trials are reviewed by a review board, usually either centrally or locally, that deem that this trial is both necessary and ethically concerned, is ethical so that the patient should not be concerned about receiving a substandard of care. Almost all trials end up comparing either a novel drug to what is the current standard of care, what the patient would be receiving otherwise, even if they weren't on the clinical trial. So, and I know a lot of patients are concerned that when they sign up for the clinical trial, I think a lot of patients want to be on the research arm, thinking and hoping that the research arm will be better than the standard of care. And then unfortunately, if we knew that the research arm would be better than the standard of care, then it would not be a clinical trial. It would already be the standard of care. And I think, the importance of these trials are both for the positive trials as well as negative trials. And I think all the positive trials are easy to talk about the importance for all the drugs that have been recently approved, such as Opdivo was recently approved, the immunotherapy, and probably cabozantinib, which has recently been shown to be efficacious in the second line. But then there's also negative trials that I think are equally important to show us how to treat patients. And one of the big examples in kidney cancer were the trials involving the anti-VEGF therapies for patients with resected kidney cancer, trying to prevent the kidney cancer from returning to stage 4 disease. And I think a lot of us, probably patients and physicians alike, thought, well, if the drug works in the stage 4 setting, then hopefully it will work in the stage 3 setting and prevent recurrence. And many patients being on these trials and having placebos, assigned to either placebo or active treatment, and treatment that's fairly toxic, and to show us that, in fact, giving the clinical getting the anti-VEGF therapies were not effective. And so that was very important to show us that, no, that's not what we need to be doing in the adjuvant setting. So without those studies, we would have never really known what is the right thing to do. So in summary on clinical trials, I always highly encourage patients to consider them. I do recognize that a lot of patients it's not quite the right fit for their personality. Some patients do not like the unknown aspect of being possibly randomized, and I do want to emphasize not all trials are randomized. Sometimes they're just single-arm studies. But I think if patients could keep an open mind when presented with clinical trials just at least think about it, I think that would be a help because, as we know right now, I think the number is somewhere around 3% of all patients actually go on clinical trials. And that's 97% of patients that are not. And just think about how much faster we could come up with the solutions to many of our problems if more patients would participate in clinical trials. So next, let's talk a little bit about managing side effects and pain. So this is, I think I'll echo what Dr. Campbell was saying, a very important aspect of managing patients with kidney cancer. Side effects is very common with all of the therapies we give, and we'll talk specifically about some of those as well as pain. Before we get into the specifics, I just want to emphasize how important the communication is about with the patient and the provider, and that's kind of the third point of this. Without clear communication, there's just really no effective way to manage any of these toxicities, and the communication has to be both ways, and it starts with the provider and the team explaining what are the typical toxicities for all of these medicines, but then also giving the patient an open door policy to call or at Mayo Clinic we use a portal system, a messaging system, so patients can email us through a secure portal, which I find extremely convenient since nobody has to be on hold. We utilize that a lot. But just if there's any questions, just ask. There's no such thing as the cliche of any dumb questions. But in terms of toxicity, I think there are the two classes of drugs that are really taking over for kidney cancer, and the first being the anti-VEGF drugs, which are of course been approved since the mid-2000s and are still the mainstay and backbone of therapy. So that's the VEGF drugs, anti-vascular endothelial growth factor receptor pathways, and those include drugs like Sutent or pazopanib or axitinib or sorafenib, or a lot of the IBs, which inhibit vascular endothelial growth factor, which is an angiogenesis marker. So all these drugs have a couple things in common, including raising the patient's blood pressure. So patients with low blood pressure might have to eventually be on a blood pressure medication, and those with high blood pressure to begin with, sometimes we have to raise their medications. The second more common or common effect is, I would say, fatigue. A lot of patients just kind of feel a little bit not quite 100%, I would say. Now, I will say that some patients who have a heavy burden of disease and feel extremely symptomatic before starting the drug do actually feel a lot more energy once they start the drug rather than less. Which gets to the point that I was going to bring up later, but I'll talk about it now. The side effects profile there is no completely common patient. Of course, everybody reacts differently. So while there is a book, no one really follows the book to the T. There's always exceptions. There's always patients who have the side effects sooner than expected, later than expected, or some that aren't expected or never even have side effects. So, again, emphasizing patients, even though we will give them an outline of what we might expect to happen, that doesn't always happen. And again, so we got to always just be prepared for any type of side effects. The next most common side effect for the VEGF drugs are probably diarrhea, which can be mild to severe. These are, again, relatively easily managed by either over-the-counter anti-diarrheal medicines like Imodium, or if diet modification can certainly help. And then if we max those things out, then we might have to reduce the dose of the drug. And I know a lot of patients get nervous about reducing the drug dose and worried about efficacy, and I clearly understand their concern there. However, we just have to emphasize that we gotta have a balance of quality and quantity, and also that many of the symptoms will resolve once we lower the dose. And then subsequently, we can raise it back, and a lot of times the symptoms don't reoccur. So that's sometimes a hard message for patients. I think they hear us, but don't necessarily want to accept having a lower dose. The next most common side effects for this drug, this class of drugs, is something known as the hand-foot syndrome. So that's tenderness of the feet, the bottoms of your soles and the palms of your hands, and that's basically caused by these drugs disrupting, I believe, the blood supply and blood flow and the angiogenesis, and causing some kind of vascular problems, and it can be very painful for patients. And there are a lot of tricks to help reduce some of these side effects, including keeping your hands and feet lubricated, and if you can, wearing comfortable shoes and off your feet as much as you can. But sometimes, despite our best efforts, these symptoms still continue. And again, we can try modifying the doses, either to lower doses or different dose schedules. So again, even though they're common and they are painful, or all these symptoms, the important point is that they can be modified, and we can still keep the patient on the drugs. Moving over to the immunotherapy side effects, these are quite different than the VEGF drugs, in that those side effects are, for the most part, I would say, a lot less overall, and certainly less severe overall. And so when we grade side effects based on the severity of the symptoms, and grade 3-4 are two highest grades, whereas these immunotherapy, single agent immunotherapies at least, have grade 3-4 toxicities in the range of 10% of patients, whereas the VEGF drugs is probably closer to 30% and 40%. So in general, much better tolerated. However, there are exceptions where some patients have really bad side effects to the immune therapies. But the immune therapies in general cause, I'd say, three main side effects. One is fatigue. The next is rash. I'll put rash and itching together. And then the third would probably be diarrhea in terms of most common. But most of these are very minor. I like to use the example of, Jimmy Carter was able to tolerate these drugs, our former president at age of, I believe, 92, 93. So we have no problems giving these drugs to patients who are, even quite old. Again, all of these side effects are caused by activation of the immune system. So instead of the immune system doing what we want it to do, is just to be activated to fight the tumor, it's actually fighting some of our bodies, including our colon and skin, and that's causing an inflammation. And the treatment of these side effects can range for mild symptoms, such as just rash and itching that are minor. We can recommend lubricants and Benadryls and antihistamines, creams, and such over-the-counter type easy home remedies that take away the majority of these symptoms. There are a very few subset of patients that will have severe rash or severe fatigue or severe diarrhea or liver functions or something of that nature. And then the ultimate solution, or the fire extinguisher for these drugs, is turning off the immune system, which we usually end up doing with steroids. prednisone and things like that. I believe am I at the end of my 13 minutes? I'm pretty close, correct?
I think you're doing just fine, actually. Wonderfully. Excellent.
Okay. Should I a couple more minutes?
Sure, absolutely.
Right. All right. So that's it for side effects and pain. And let's do the last topic about communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And, you know, this is, I think, the essence and the art of oncology right here. This is where, it's easy to read algorithms and tell patients, you know, if you have this cancer, we should treat you with this, and if you progress on that, we'll give you this, and if you progress that. But the art of oncology is really trying to balance the quality and quantity, and recognizing that all of our drugs and have toxicities, and that we don't need to necessarily push these toxicities to the limit in order for the patients to get effective results. And sometimes even the harder we put, when we push as hard as we can, we still might not get effective results. But this is where, you know, we have to be very clear with patients, you know, what our expectations of our goals are, to try to describe what type of results we are expecting, and be very, I would say, honest, but also hopeful. You know, that's how I try to be, at least. Is you never want to promise too much, but you want to. And again, to use a cliche, we prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. And we use let the patient end up guiding how aggressive we want to be. There are always therapies that we can offer. There's almost an infinite list of therapies of things we could try, either through clinical trials or chemo, or even things, you know, that just, you know, anything that after the standard of care. But we just have to be realistic with our patients and explain to them that the further we get along therapies, you know, the less likely we are to benefit from some of these drugs. But, you know, whether it's worth trying it or not, I think is up to the individual patient. And the way at least I practice is not to make the decisions for the patients, but to help advise them on those decisions and try to really get at the essence of their being and where on that pendulum of risk and benefit are they at that present time, and how much risk are they willing to assume for a potential improvement in quality or quantity. So I think that's about it. Wraps up what I was going to talk about. Maybe move on to the next.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joseph. And I think all the content that you covered, but indeed also addressing the art of oncology, which I know there'll be probably questions during the Q&A. That's such an important area in terms of just the art of delivering care. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Burden. Ms. Burden is a dietitian, and she is a supervisor of clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Burden is going to address the nutritional concerns and tips, and I'm now going to turn this program over to Ms. Burden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation addressing nutritional concerns in the presence of renal cell cancer. My goal today is to discuss tips for managing side effects that can impact your nutrition. Like has been mentioned earlier in today's presentation, the level of response to different treatments and the occurrence of even side effects happening is really individualized. So when I'm speaking today, it's a very general overview, but continuing to work with your healthcare team as different things come up throughout your treatment, questions you have, the earlier the better. So just communicating is the big key. So to start with, eating well during your treatment can provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better, have faster recovery from side effects. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow the healing process. By meeting nutritional goals during your treatment, maintaining your weight, and preserving lean muscle mass, you're going to work towards your goal of a more improved tolerance to treatment, hopefully. You may be placed on an individualized diet, something that may be different from what you're doing right now, and this could be in response to your disease process, how your body is being, how it's reacting to what's going on, maybe part of the treatment itself. And so there might be some changes that happen, but they're all in response to helping you tolerate the treatment and have the best outcomes. Common side effects, we've heard some today about the diarrhea. Some patients also may experience nausea and vomiting, have a decrease in appetite. Sometimes foods don't taste as good as they did, or they just don't have as much flavor. And, of course, the bowel function issue of diarrhea or constipation. Fatigue is also a side effect some patients experience. This can be due to a lot of different factors, but nevertheless, it's part of your overall, overall care and important to address with your healthcare team. So to give some tips on how to address or even start recognizing that there might be a need to reach out to your healthcare team, if you notice that the nausea and vomiting or poor appetite is something that's consistent, that it's interfering with your ability to eat. Some things you can try, pretty benign interventions. One thing is eliminating offending odors. Sometimes warm foods carry a lot more odor, and when you're not really feeling well to begin with, sometimes walking into a room or being in the kitchen whenever everyone's preparing meals, the smells can kind of be overwhelming and just take away your appetite. So cold foods might be something to consider. You can still get good protein sources and good nutrition through cold foods such as tuna salad, chicken salad, those sorts of things. But as a cold food, they do carry less odors. Bland foods might be something else to consider, and sometimes it's not just the smell, but it's also strong flavors, and flavors that you may enjoy at one point, you may not prefer at another, and that can oftentimes make somebody feel nauseated or just turn them off from eating altogether. So trying some blander items, maybe lessening the seasoning might be a way to do that. Fried or greasy foods can be very heavy and very filling, and if you're having GI concerns such as diarrhea, eating high-fat foods can really make that worse. So even though you may not think you're doing as much as you might be, just kind of examining your diet with your healthcare team, reaching out to your dietitian, and sometimes foods are prepared or packaged in a different way, and we aren't always aware of how that is, so we may not be aware of the amount of fat that's actually in the food. Eating small, frequent meals can be helpful. When you just aren't feeling well or if you're tired and you're resting often, your eating times change. And so oftentimes, so does the volume. When you're not as active or you're not awake as much, then you're not going to be, engaging in mealtime. So just being mindful of snacking in between if that's something that you're challenged with, and focusing on foods that are higher in calories and protein without having a large volume can be really a stress relief. So talking with your dietitian, she can help you formulate that individualized plan. Stress, stress is part of, I think, cancer care overall, and part of life too, so you kind of get a double doozy when you're going through treatment. Stress can cause us to lose our appetite as well, worrying, all of that works together and can be very impactful in affecting your overall energy level. So if you can move whatever you can do physically, going for a walk, getting outside, a change of environment. Physical activity can actually help reduce stress. It can also help with bowel function. It can also help with appetite. So if that's something that's appropriate during your treatment and your healthcare team doesn't have any restrictions, then that might be something to consider. Taste changes are another thing, and like I said earlier, sometimes it's about focusing on blander food items to help with tolerating things a little bit better. Another part of that is, though, is hydration. And at different times, you might have directions on how much fluid to take or if that is something to consider. But if you are able to drink and not have any restrictions, nevertheless, drinking what you're allowed to drink is important. It helps our oral environment. Keeping a good oral hygiene is also important. If we don't eat or drink a lot, our mouth becomes dry, and I've noticed it becomes very habitual sometimes with patients. And so as we become dehydrated, which can happen, especially if you're sleeping a lot, if you're taking, not eating as much, you probably aren't drinking as much. So nausea can also start to become more amplified. You can have headaches and feel dizzy. So dehydration is very powerful. So be mindful of your hydration and your fluid status. Some other things that patients might experience, we've kind of touched on this throughout, but the change in bowel function. So oftentimes, like if you're, you know, have a surgical intervention or if you're having pain or something like that and you're given pain medications, some patients can experience constipation, or if you're having a lot of nausea, sometimes nausea medication can also result in constipation. Diarrhea can be a result of some of the treatments. As well, so, you know, talk with your healthcare team about the appropriate intervention. The reason for the side effect you're experiencing might need or might be better served by a more individualized approach. So talking with them about that before implementing something on your own. Now, some easy things you can do that are relatively benign if you're, you know, just starting to have a little bit of constipation, you don't know why, make sure that you're drinking enough fluid. That oftentimes is one of the most common reasons for constipation outside of the pain medication. And then if you're having some diarrhea, evaluate, you know, am I eating foods that are too greasy? Am I, you know, eating a lot of sugary foods? That can make it worse. What am I drinking? So kind of writing some of that information down and taking it to your healthcare team can help them help you better. Sometimes adding fiber might be an option. Sometimes you may want to reduce the fiber. So, you know, again, talking with your healthcare team is the pivotal point, because your individual needs, just like Dr. Joseph mentioned, everybody's response to treatment is different, and how side effects express themselves are very unique. And so you want what's best for you. That pretty much wraps it up for me, Carolyn. I think I'm going to hand it back over to you now.
Oh, thank you so much. That was really so comprehensive and really excellent. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so again, thank you for always doing such a great presentation. And now our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlin. Ms. Edlin is an oncology social worker, and she's our online support group program director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlin is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. I'd like to start first by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with renal cell cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups. In fact, we offer an online group specifically dedicated to the needs and experiences of renal cell and kidney cancer patients. You can register for this group on Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org. This group and our groups in general offer a unique opportunity to connect with others impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are here to help. So please do contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Edlin. That was really outstanding and really wonderful review of cancer care services. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. And so I'm going to ask Candace to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions and really to ask your questions. It's a wonderful chance to ask those questions that you would like to ask your healthcare team but would like to kind of do a practice run here, or any questions that you might have that our expertise of our speakers would help you with as well. So, Candace, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
And our first question comes from Jamie on our from one of our online participants. So the question is, do you recommend a certain diet or avoiding certain foods while being treated for renal cell cancer? So Ms. Bearden, could you address that?
That's a great question. It really, again, depends on the side effects and your individual needs. Oftentimes, a specialized diet may be required. For example, watching your electrolytes or your protein level, even your fluid level, just depending on what you're being faced with. And so I would absolutely meet with your healthcare team to see what your individual needs are. But overall speaking, it's really about managing side effects, and if you aren't having any side effects and there isn't a need for a specialized diet, then what we go back to is a plant-based diet where we really follow the AICR guidelines, and then as unique situations come up and challenges are faced, then we can just work through those and individualize that diet for your particular needs.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from Alan, one of our online participants. Does kidney cancer put me at risk for complications such as liver function abnormalities or bone problems? How can I avoid such complications? Dr. Joseph, could you address that? Actually, and then Dr. Campbell, or probably both of you might like to address that one. Dr. Joseph, like to go first?
Sure. So I think I understood the question to be, does my cancer affect the liver or bones, or does my cancer treatment affect?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So it's, does kidney cancer, but actually both probably would make a sense, but the question was, does kidney cancer put me at risk for complications such as liver function abnormalities or bone problems, and how can I avoid such complications? But I think answering it for both would probably make sense,
sure.
Both in terms of treatment and disease as well. Thank you.
Sure. So, I mean, the disease itself does not put patients at any increased risk for liver failure or bone failure. I guess let me take a step back. So someone with a history of kidney cancer who is now, let's say, cured of their kidney cancer, have their kidney cancer removed, you know, are not at any higher risk for, you know, their organs to fail or anything like that. But the patient might be asking, does kidney cancer ever metastasize to the liver or the bone? And if that happens, certainly, you know, not necessarily liver failure, but, you know, damage to the liver and damage to the bone can certainly occur from the metastatic process, but not just because you had a history. It would have to be because the cancer recurred in those areas. And in terms of treatment, of course, another relatively common side effect of both the targeted agents as well as the immunotherapies do involve some liver toxicity, but never to the point of, you know, people use the word liver failure. I think that's a really strong word that means, oh gosh, the patient's going to need a liver transplant. No, that never happens. It's more or less a little bit, I would call it a liver irritation, if you will, where we can get away with not irritating the liver by holding the dose or steroids or something like that. Bone, the same way. You know, if the cancer goes to the bone, then certainly we can treat the cancer in the bone both with the targeted therapies, immunotherapy, sometimes even radiation therapy. And then there's other drugs called, generally we call them just bone strengthening agents that prevent fractures in patients with cancer. So,
excellent. And Dr. Campbell, do you want to add anything? Or
I would echo what Dr. Joseph just had to say, so not much to add.
Okay, excellent. Okay, thank you. Great team. And we have a question. This question, which I'm going to direct to Dr. Campbell. As Marsha, an online participant, stage 4 cancer here, Votrient only worked for about 2 to 3 months. Now, Opdivo has been doing well for 4 months. Will Opdivo one day stop working as Votrient did? And if so, is there any way of knowing when this might happen? Is there any chance Opdivo might work indefinitely? So this is a very wonderful question, Marsha, and it's a good one to ask your healthcare team. But I am going to ask Dr. Campbell to address in a general way so that you can be more informed. And then, of course, you'll go to your healthcare team who actually know all about you in more detail. But it's an excellent question. Dr. Campbell, if you could address this in a general way.
I would say that this really is the million-dollar question that we are all waiting for in some respects. So this is, I'm going to try to keep this answer a little bit shorter than it potentially could be, as this has been entire topics of an hour at conferences before. So with Opdivo, patients that have an early response seem to be patients that have a very durable response. Without being able to see the images and knowing how the response was initially, I would at least say that it's a very encouraging sign that the cancer is responding. We have had patients have durable responses with Opdivo on the range of multiple years. However, we do not have the long-term follow-up with Opdivo that we have in some of the older immune agents like Yervoy or with cytokine-based treatment to know how patients do potentially 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road like we do with some of those older agents. So I would just say from our knowledge, it's too early for us to say exactly what the future holds with Opdivo, but I'm very much encouraged with the fact that it's having an initial effect on the cancer.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Joseph, do you want to comment in terms of
sure.
this as well?
I think that that's a great, like Dr. Campbell said, million-dollar question. And, you know, patients come to us with these questions a lot, and a lot of times they get the answer, you know, we don't know. Sometimes I think that's annoying, but I think sometimes that's also a sign that, you know, how fast this field is progressing. That the answer is I don't know, because everything is moving so quickly and we don't know the answers down the road to these questions. With my experience, I'm with Opdivo and other immunotherapies, I think I'm going to put my neck out and say, you know, like the older immunotherapies like high-dose IL-2, in my experience, the patients who have developed a complete remission to these to Opdivo or other immunotherapies. You know, of course, there are other ones like MPDL or atezolizumab, which is the Roche compound. But if that happens, and I do see that, I am going to believe that that's going to be a very, very durable, if not curative, type of response. However, on the other hand, if we have a mixed response or stable disease or maybe a partial remission where some of it goes away but not, I don't know. I'm not going to say that it's not going to be durable, but it might not, if it's going to echo the history, it might not be as durable. And that's what we saw with high-dose IL-2. But there are other strategies for patients who have a non-complete remission, such as resecting residual disease, radiating residual disease, and others. So don't. There's no reason to not, you know, hope for the best. Maybe we can convert all partial remissions to completes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So that was an excellent question, I must say. Marcia, thank you for that really outstanding question, really. Clearly, our participants on the call are really asking very cutting-edge questions. And we have another question from one of our participants, from Alana. And the question is, in terms of, and this I'm going to ask actually our speakers to address, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Joseph, to address, should I get a second opinion before starting my treatment? So if you could comment on the concept of second opinions and just helping people to understand that process.
Sure. So I'll take the lead here. And so at MD Anderson, a lot of patients that I see as a large referral center are second, third, sometimes fourth, fifth opinions, depending on the patient's background and what their interests are and understanding all the potentials. I always think getting a second opinion makes sense if it can be done in a reasonable length of time. I've had a lot of patients who have started therapy because of you know, fear or whatever it may be within a week of seeing me in a second opinion, and that can sometimes limit our ability to offer, you know, consideration of a clinical trial or other options. I think second opinions, just to have, you know, a second set of eyes, and, you know, if you come to a place like Mayo Clinic with Dr. Joseph or MD Anderson with myself and my colleagues, we often have conferences where many different groups of physicians kind of weigh in on what they would do in terms of treatment strategies. So you get a lot of minds together to collectively help decide what's the best and most cutting-edge treatment option, and I always think that's in the patient's benefit.
Excellent. Thank you. And
Dr.
Joseph? Yes, sure.
Absolutely. That's the right answer. So I always tell patients, even when, you know, I encourage second opinions when they see me, and I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of kidney cancer. Second opinions are also, I think, for me personally, good for the doctor too, because nobody wants to move forward with a patient and have a care plan that the patient's not 100% confident in the direction that it's going. So if there's any doubt at all about whether the right thing or, you know, I absolutely love patients get second opinions, and not only just to hear the standard of care, which I think is relatively straightforward, but, you know, to open their eyes to a whole new world of clinical trials that may not be a part of the standard of care. So I wholeheartedly 100% support it, even with my patients. I'll send them over to see Dr. Campbell any day of the week.
So this is a very confirmatory, I hope, for the audience to recognize this, that you want to ask questions of your doctor, you have a right to get a second opinion. These are really important concepts. I hope this program has helped you. We have actually really our speakers, I want to thank them. They have been outstanding, and all of your questions have really been really amazing, and they really helped to allow our speakers to elaborate further on topics, and, of course, all of you who have been listening. Now, we recognize that you have many questions, and I see there are more questions in queue than we could possibly address in an hour. So I first of all want to say that actually I want to give you just information of how you can get your medical questions that you may have at this point that you didn't get to have addressed. And for those, I would suggest you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, and their information specialists always are there after our calls to take your questions. And for those of you who would like to access services from our oncology social workers at Cancer Care, the practical help, financial help, counseling services, support group, If you'd like to actually sign up for another workshop or get some publications from us, please do contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. And for those of you internationally, you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And actually, if you've been a frequent, a different look, so it's wonderful. I hope you'll find it to be very useful and lots of good information there. Also, I do want to remind you this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And I don't want anyone to think that you're alone as this program concludes. I want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care community and that we're here to help you, and we truly are here for you. And we have a wonderful staff of oncology social workers and experts here that can help you with your concerns and questions. Also, I do want to let you all know we did talk about clinical trials today, but we are doing a program specifically on clinical trials and updates and how they work on May 20th. And many of you have signed up for that program, but if you haven't, you'll be getting more information about all of our upcoming programs, and I really invite you to participate in that one or any of the others that would seem interesting to you. I should also mention that on April 27th, we're doing a program on immuno-oncology, a promising new approach to treating cancer, and that also may be of interest to many of you on the call today. So we have lots of things coming up, so basically do participate in those as well. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.